If I was using an operational amplifier as a negative voltage device, in other words, a voltage inverter, and the feedback resistor is what's determining the current gain capability, and I've got my three mics going from three separate resistors into that common negative port of the op amp. And now, as I short out any one of those mics, it will have no effect on the other two, because each mic through its coming resistor is driving what it thinks is a virtual ground, that negative lead of the op amp. So therefore, there's very little mixing action between them, and you short out any one of those mics before its individual summing resistor, it has no effect on the rest of the circuit as I see it, Eric. Is that the way a well-made audio amplifier summing circuit with three mics would work? KE2EJ, KE2LIW?
Well, in the consumer world, usually they're talking input impedance, okay. In the audio world, you tend to be talking about 600 ohms, so the 600 ohm world, where the individual isolation to the summing junction between the resistors is usually only like 1K or even smaller. There it has an effect, but in the consumer world, no, that's perfectly fine.
I could keep your audio mics very happy by each audio mic goes through a 600 ohm resistor into the negative lead of an op amp where the positive lead is virtually grounded. That negative lead becomes a virtual ground. Therefore, each one of those mics is launching a certain amount of current into that virtual ground and negative lead of the op amp. And the other two mics don't even know that it has happened. So if I short out any one of those mics now, I think I'm independently cutting off that mic, very little leakage, and no effect on the gain of the other mics when I do that switching on or off. See what I'm getting on that one? You're using this beautiful characteristic of a voltage-inverting operational amplifier. That virtual ground really stops them. If the op amp's got enough gain, it stops all mixing between those mics. KE2EJ for any comment? KE2RIW in the TechNet.
KE2EJ, I agree with you, except that we forget that, you know, a lot of these microphones only put out 100 millivolts, 150 millivolts, and when you do that switch, you get a thump, and that's what they try to avoid.
Okay, do they get rid of that thump by throwing in you could use a FET transistor and slowly make it conducting. So you're going towards 0 ohms, but you do it slowly, and I think you can stop the FOP, if you know what I mean. Oh, how do they stop the FOP, Eric?
Well, bunching. Most of the stuff that I have ever worked on, they tend not to use a summing junction. Each microphone gets its own little input switch. Kinds of microphones in terms of in my world where the will actually send a voltage to the microphone. And there you don't really want to short the microphone, you just want to open it.
With your broadcast type 600 ohm microphone, what's the longest lead I can run out of that microphone into the rest of the amplifier of the broadcast center without picking up hum and noise and whatever? And I guess if I got to run a really long lead, I've got to put a preamplifier at the mic. So, is there a lead length that you guys try to never go beyond to a microphone, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, there is. They try not to go more than 300 meters. But don't forget, it's all balanced.
Whenever I'm watching a weather lady on broadcast television, she's giving us the weather report. Every one of them are wearing a portable microphone. If you know where to look, you can see the microphone on the rappel, on the rappel, you know what I mean, the collar, so to speak, of their blouse or dress. And quite often it's what now? Safety pin, so to speak, to their back, to the middle, to the small of their back. And if you see them standing sideways, you can see that device. I presume these things are working on UHF or SHF frequencies, and these portable RF microphones that every weather broadcaster uses. My guess is they're a fairly standard product. Imagine those microphones come in any color you want to match the clothing you want you're wearing that particular day. I am guessing there is a person assigned to installing that wiring under their clothing so that it doesn't show. KE2EJ, giving us the inside of the broadcast industry. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Wireless microphones, as they're called. Big name in it is Sennheiser. They transmit into the receivers, like Versailles. There's a whole bunch of them. The microphone itself could be made by Sony, or it could be a Countryman. The thing about it is big as the head of a pin in some of them. But if you go back a few years before wireless microphones, there's actually a little clip that clips onto the belt, and then the XLR cable hooks into that, and it runs into the stage box, which goes back to the audio guy, goes into a console. Now, most of the past, actually it's all up in the air right now, because a lot of the wireless microphones use what we call the white space, so the spaces in between television channels. Now that they've taken away from channel 52 on up, where a lot of microphones used to live, those are no longer legal to use, because they're in the LTE stage and a few other things. After they do this repacking, by the way, the first stage of the reverse auction has been completed. So we're getting closer to moving more TV channels and giving it to the phone companies. All of those microphones, which they made after they had produced the upper UHF channel, now those are going to have to go away, and what they're beginning to do is they're beginning to use 0.4 gig for it. And they don't work that well when you go far away, whereas the Sennheisers that were in the UHF and even VHF parts to the band, they work wonderfully. So you got to consider that you're in a small space, so when you're doing an outside production, you're on a golf course where you've got to go several hundred feet, it becomes a big problem.
I am guessing, Eric, that many of these wireless microphones where your personality in front of the tube is wearing is really an ISD, interrupted feedback. In other words, he's not only got a microphone that goes to that transmitter that's pinned to his backside, he's also got an earpiece which he can hear any questions he gets from the studio. Somebody might ask him, hey, is it really going to be that bad of rain tomorrow? Is the hail going to be that bad? And so it's called interrupted feedback because the earpiece that the person is wearing does not display the audio that they are generating. So that, in other words, they can hear the person in the studio talking to them. They don't hear their own audio, I think, in most cases. Is that the way it works, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2EJ, in terms of a news announcer or a weather person, if you look at their back, you'll see they have two boxes. One is an ISD box, one is the microphone. And what they feed the person into the ear is called a mixed mining, meaning they hear everything except for their audio. And the way they do that is in the console, there's actually many different paths in which the audio can take. And on a modern console, you can hit the mixed mining button. What it essentially does is delete the audio coming from their microphone, includes everything else. But when you're talking about a weather person, the mixed mining is usually the director giving instructions and so on and so forth. But they'll hear the other people, especially if you're doing a round table, that kind of thing. They'll hear everyone else's microphone except their own.
When you look at a round table like Charlie Rue's program, where he might have four individual guests, each one of them is wearing a wireless microphone, each one of them has an earpiece, I am guessing, each one of them can hear the audio of all other guests except him. So the audio mixing and matching and whatever going on behind the scenes sounds like in the case of four guests, it can get a little bit elaborate until you flip just the right switches. I bet you there are times that it comes out wrong. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, in the case of Charlie Rose, the only time that they'll put earpieces on the guest is if they have a satellite feed coming from somewhere. And there will be times where they forget to subtract it from the satellite feed. You'll see the guy start talking and then start stuttering because he hears himself coming back 3 seconds later, and it's, you know, very confusing. It's as though I made Dick listen to the repeater through the internet, or you know, some delay that's making him crazy. You have to take your headphones off.
Yeah, this very repeater used to have a delay which gave you the time to take out the PL tone. So there was like a half second, quarter second, whatever delay.
No, it's the touch tone, not the PL tone.
But I should have said touch tone. But I remember it took quite a bit of training on my part to be able to talk around that. I usually ended up turning down the audio quite low into my ear, so to speak. I was able to avoid listening to myself coming back with a delay if the audio volume was low enough. And it takes some training. And like you said, you take anybody's audio and you feed it back to them with delay, they will almost always go into a stutter. There's a huge number of feedback systems going on inside of the human being that we are not aware of. You can take a man blindfolded, tell him to stick out his arm straight out in front of him, 30 degrees to the right, 20 degrees up, and even though he's blindfolded, he knows where every part of his body is. You'd be amazed the amount of feedback there is inside of a human being. And so the speech feedback is probably a pretty complicated system. The very first time you hear a tape recording of your own voice, you say, gee, that's not me. Well, you spent a lifetime hearing yourself from inside your own head through your own bone conduction. And so there's a limited amplitude of feedback you get there, but now you start adding the electronic delay. And are there any personalities that you know that can continue to talk with that delay without the stuttering? Eric, over you, KQLIW.
Believe it or not, there actually are quite a few people that can handle it. They recognize it. You can see them wince a little bit, but they go on as though nothing has happened. And then they scream loudly when the camera is off them.
On a couple of occasions, I've seen a person rip the earpiece out of his ear because that was happening, so that he could continue talking. I bet you've seen a few of those, Eric. Go ahead.
I've seen a few of those tons of blows. And you did ask who was the person that actually wired up the person and put the microphone through the woman's chest to put it in the right place. That's called the audio assist system. A2 is known in the business.
A2. And in most cases, if the guest is female, I'd like to believe the A2 is also female. But I think there's been a couple of cases where the A2 available happened to be the wrong sex. Is that true, Eric?
It's almost always like that. When you're dealing with an actor or an actress, there's not a problem in the world. They'll open their blouses the next day. When you're dealing with strangers that come in from the outside, what you'll generally do is ask the female to grab, you know, reach in through their blouse, pull it up, and then they'll flip it on to the appropriate.
Now, I presume that wiring to that mic must be very small in diameter because it almost never shows through the clothing. Have some of those mics become a ribbon lead so that it doesn't have any diameter to it that will show through the clothing? Eric, go ahead.
Now, consider the size of the microphone to start with. Use your RG-172. That's pretty thin. Well, think of something that's maybe three times smaller.
G2RY. Mr. RY, give us your full call and your name. K2LIW.
G2RY. David, how are you?
Okay. David, you keep talking and then key the mic, so we keep hearing 2RY. So give us your full call, and I think you've got a comment. Go right ahead, David.
KG2RY. Eric, those little clip-on mics, would another name for those mics be lavalier? Lavalier mics. Go ahead.
That's one type of microphone, yes. Call it a lavalier. We do call them a lavalier. There are other forms of it, but that's sort of like old in terminology, but yeah, we call them labs, actually.
That's a transmitter and receiver that's connected to the person's back of their clothing. that battery in there, who makes sure the battery is charged, the battery is in good shape, how often do those batteries go dead? There are times when the personality all of a sudden is not producing audio. So are those portable mics good for 4 hours of continuous operation, so to speak, Eric? K-E-2-E-J, K-2-R-I-W.
K-2-R-I-W, K-E-2-E-J. In any studio, you'll find a cabinet that's full of Duracell, 9-volt and 1.5-volt AA batteries. Anytime you do a show, you open the thing up, you throw out the old battery, you put a nice, fresh new one. Typically, they'll last about 12, 14 hours, but nobody tries to even push them that far because they don't want to be caught with a handstand.
So you're saying those wireless mics are running on 1.5-volt pen lights or double A's or triple A's? Is that what they're usually running on, Eric? Go ahead.
Okay. Some of the electric microphones, there's a phantom power. They can either, if they're directly wired to the console will send 48 volts down the line. Limited current, of course. A lot of electric microphones that are wired will have a single AA battery acting as a bias for the microphone. The transmitters typically are all 9-volt batteries.
So you're saying that wireless microphone that's connected to the personality is running RF-wise on a 9-volt transistor battery. I don't consider those as reliable as AA's or AAA's. Now back to you, Eric.
Well, it's nice that you feel that way, but every piece of gear that you buy will have a spot, and that's for a single 9-volt battery. Actually, you slide it in, no clip on the top, it just slides in, there's spring contact. It's set up in such a way that if you put it in backwards, it doesn't make contact usually. There's a piece of plastic with two different size holes, and usually the back of the box is a little piece of plastic that sort of angles up and slides in, so that way it clips in and stays secure. But, that's what they use, and they work well.
AUZ with a comment.
AUZ, we're going to pick you up in a minute. I shouldn't have such a negative opinion about 9-volt batteries. I think the vast majority of smoke detectors and CO detectors are running on a 9-volt battery. Mr. AUZ, give us your full call and name, sir. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. Alex, KB2KUZ. I think one of the largest screw-ups or gaffes in television history was when David Letterman gave one of his very funniest monologues, and he didn't find out until it was all done that his wireless mic had crapped out about two-thirds of the way through. Back to you, Dick.
And I guess Alec, he had some strong, salty words for his support crew in that case. Is that true?
My things do fail.
They do. Nothing's perfect. He was rather upset. He took the microphone off his collar, and he took the backpack off, and he threw it across the stage. And I think he sat down and stopped speaking for a while he gathered his thoughts.
I think I've read a report somewhere that he's thinking of coming back. Is that true? Have you heard that?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
There was one report that's not well documented saying that he was considering coming back. Oh, well. Alrighty, so we got some interesting microphone information from the Vertcast world, John.
Let me tell you one other thing.
Go for it.
I can't tell you how many hours I've spent with magnifying glass and this little Princess 7-watt soldering iron, replacing the cables that got that break, putting new connectors on, reconnecting it into this tiny little microphone. That's usually what fails most times. Occasionally somebody will forget to change the battery, but that's pretty rare. But the biggest failure that you get is a mic cable.
So each of those mic cables are being tugged through people's clothing during the installation. I presume you can only do that a certain number of times before you get wire failure, fatigue failure of the wire. Is that what goes on, Eric?
It comes in lots of different forms. You get the cord on belt, people step on it, get the snag on something because you don't realize that the length of the microphone cable is pretty long. So you've got to be able to fit on any human being. And usually you have to just kind of tuck some of it into their pants so that way it doesn't show.
Are most of those wireless microphones, Eric, one-way receiver, indoor transmitter? In other words, very few of them are a transceiver. Over to you, Eric.
Microphone is pretty much only a transceiver. Receivers are mounted in a rack. The antennas are mounted on the ceiling of the studio. Everybody would use these little Yagis. And my method, people would think I'm crazy, but after they experience it, they love it. I use Radiax in the studio. Every studio that I built, I put Radiax in. Not only do you have ISBs, which is a receiver, and a separate packet goes to the earpiece, but the stage manager, the stage hands, the camera people, they may be wearing what we call a belt pack that's not wired. It's a wireless belt pack, a wireless intercom that goes, not only does it go both ways, but many of them have two channels. One channel is the director, another channel is program audio. Various different mixes like that. You can even have some of them with program audio in one ear and director in the other ear.
If I'm broadcasting, if my station is broadcasting a personality standing in front of an event, like say for instance Dallas, Texas, where the studio through the satellite link is talking to him and he's talking back and he's wearing everything wireless, I think you're saying he's wearing two separate devices. One is the transmitter from his microphone and the other is the receiver that goes to his earpiece. So there are two separate radios connected to his back. That's never a combined transceiver per se. Is that what you're saying, Eric? K2RIW?
That's absolutely correct. And you'll notice other people, like the person that cures them, they'll be wearing a headset with a microphone. And they may have two mups, and in the two mups they may have an audio feed in one ear and a director feed in the other ear.
My question?
Yeah, we'll go back to you in a second. These are kept separate so you have complete independent selection of frequencies. What's the reason why they were never combined into a transceiver with a synthesized frequency select on them, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, modern microphones, RF mics are synthesized these days, noise control. Frequencies were written on them, usually in the form of a letter and a number. So they broke up, most of the manufacturers created their own table of frequencies, the associated number. So, you know that the host was on A1 and the guest was on A2 and the guest off the side might have been on B1. You just simply match up the number and letter on the receiver to the person who's using it. The reason I guess that they were never combined is every situation is different, and also the manufacturers make more money.
6DP says with a comment.
Yeah, we got David and then Al in that order. David, go ahead.
Thank you, Dave. Eric, KG2RY. Let's say David Letterman is shooting an outdoor segment on 57th Street. And he's using, all these battery-powered devices for microphones and headphones and such. How do they deal with all of that radio interference in that area or any area of New York City? Because there is a lot of that.
That's Eric.
Well, as I said before, these microphones operate in the white spaces. The white spaces are the places like you have channel 2 and 4 and 5 and 7, which means channel 3 is empty, channel 6 is empty, channel 8 is empty, and a whole lot of UHFs are empty, so that's one way. And when there's a large event where there's lots of people broadcasting, like, say, New Year's Eve in Times Square, the broadcasters have something called a coordinating committee, and they will issue frequencies that this group will use, ABC will use this block of frequencies, CBS will use that block of frequencies, so that's all well thought out long before an event ever happens. we may be planning an event a year in advance.
You've also got the inverse square law in your favor, Eric. That guy who is a personality standing on the street, he's in front of a camera. That camera is probably usually less than 10 feet away from him. I presume the receiving equipment for that remote news gathering situation, I presume the receiving equipment is on that camera per se or nearby, so the distance that that wireless mic has to work sounds to me like it's rarely beyond 50 feet. That's a guess on my part. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, if you're doing one camera in GQ, the receiver is mounted on the camera, the output of the receiver goes right into the audio jack of the camera. But when you're doing a large production, if you look carefully, even if you watch when they do music on the Today Show and they're outside, if you look carefully, you'll see a tripod that has a Yagi on it that's pointed at the stage, and that RF cable will go back into the studio, and that's what we'll see. By the way, most microphones only operate at about 50, anywhere between 50 and 100 milliwatts.
And you would trust that microphone to into a Yagi at what kind of range, Eric Grant?
I've been on a number of golf shoots, and we'll do 500-600 feet easily.
So when there's a Yagi on the other end, 500 or 600 feet, if it was a simple whip on the other end to end, it might not go that far?
Actually, if you look at the antennas aren't even whips. They're just a little piece of wire, except the right length is hanging down.
You're talking about on the equipment that the person is wearing. I'm talking about the equipment that's doing the final pickup at the site. That's, in many cases, I'd like to believe it's a little bit more than just a piece of wire hanging down. Correct me on that one, Eric.
And an outdoor, well, on any of the wireless microphones, the transmitting antenna is just a right length piece of wire that's hanging down. In the outdoor event where you need some distance, there's Yagi's pointed at the talent. What I did to avoid the Yagi problem in big studios is I put radiax in the ceiling, which is basically coax with little holes in it.
You put the radiax in the ceiling. Well done. K6TPZ, go ahead, Hal. K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6TPZ. I was just thinking back between the 50s and 60s, the broadcast field in California. What they did, they had 120 KC frequency they used as a big loop around the studio, the TV studio, and everybody wore receivers that received 120 KC. And the directors and the ETs and everything were able to hear everything going on. And they would just have a little, just an amplifier with a loop that they were wearing also. And everything was picked up. Go ahead, Eric.
Now, actually, they weren't at 150 kilohertz. They were actually at audio frequency. There was a big loop in the studio. And all the headphones had a coil in it that essentially picked it up. You also picked up the hum, and any time you walked through any kind of AC lines, you heard it, so. But that went out in the 50s. In the 60s, they started using real transmitters.
Around that time, Eric, you're right. I remember CBS out in California.
We've had a lot of fun with the audio system tonight, John. Good question. By the way, one of the things that I should have mentioned last week, when a person was asking the question about waveguides, a piece of WR90 X-band waveguide, for instance, 9/10 of an inch wide, 0.45 inch high, is the typical piece of waveguide. And the person asked, what happens if you make that dimension, the 0.45 inches, the height of the waveguide, if you make it higher or lower? And I went through that last week. One of the main kinds of lower waveguide I should have mentioned is called SIW. Let me drop it. Which I think stands for Substrate Integrated Waveguide. If you take a piece of double-sided copper-clad board, let's say, for instance, a 1/16 of an inch of dielectric thickness between the upper copper and the lower copper, and if you put a whole bunch of via holes along two edges, you have now created a piece of waveguide inside of the printed circuit board, Surface Integrated Waveguide, and it works like a charm. So, you can have waveguide signals traveling inside of the upper and lower copper sheet of your double-sided copper-clad board. And by the spacing of those via holes, you make sure that they're close enough together so that no signal can leak between them. But by changing the horizontal width of their spacings, you can make waveguides that slowly tapers like a Minerva line. You can do all kinds of, you can create reactors and capacitors and resistors and transmission lines and whatever inside of the printed circuit board itself, SIW that's called. And if you read some of the articles in the last quite a few years of microwave theory and technique, we show you a lot of these installations. KC2WGB, KQIW in the TechNet.
Hey, do a guy with a question for you, Dick.
Wait for the beeps, or go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm in the process of clearing out some of my junk, and I happen to have a bunch of these. Would you be interested in a 12-gig transmitter or receiver that's portable, that can even operate on battery, and it's intended to do video and audio? If you're interested, I'll give you a pass.
Bring it on. Sounds awful good, Eric. Go ahead. When do I go to your place and pick these up?
Anytime you want. They're sitting in the garage.
Okay. So I got to listen on the air to find out when you're at the studio, and that's when I appear.
I'm on vacation, but I'm stopping at home, not at the studio. But you pick a time.
Okay. And when I visit your home, you're going to blow my mind by showing me a real television set, and you're going to bring me out of the 19th century.
Go ahead, Eric. Nah, you'll be disappointed. The places are back. I'm trying to clean the place up. And there's no antenna sticking up off the roof, unfortunately.
Okay. So, you get over-the-air television, or I assume you'd be a satellite or a cable person.
No, I get over-the-air television. But I also get satellite, and I also get fired.
Okay. You should be getting Verizon and cable TV. Satellite and over the air. Let's see, 1, 2, 3. There's at least 4 sources, if not more. Is that true?
3 sources. Over the air, DirecTV, and Fios. I don't get cable vision.
It's not installed in your neighborhood, or you just not selected it?
It's all about money, Dick. I mean, the station helps me with one thing. I've got cable vision at the station, so, you know, I have the Fios to keep an eye on things.
That makes sense. KC2WGB, K2IW, go right ahead, John.
KC2WGB, all right, I'll go on to this next question. Should be an easy one. All right, this young man found a military radio. It's from the Second World War. And it works well, except it's missing some shields on the IF. The cans are gone, and they're rectangular structures, about inch and a quarter, inch and three measurements I'm looking at here. Yeah, let's say an inch and a quarter square and about 5 inches tall. Doesn't know the material they were made out of, and he notices that when he brings anything near them, he tunes the radio, and he just can't get it to work right. He knows those cans have to be on there. His question is, he's pretty handy, and he thinks that he can take some steel juice cans or some type of canned food cans and structure some IF shields, and he can make them rectangular or round. He's waiting for your description on how you think he should go, and he could solder them up, make nice little boxes and stuff. The question is, what type of metal should he use? Would steel be all right, or does he have to use aluminum or brass? What do you think, Dick? Back to you, KC2WGB.
Okay, I'm going to double check now. You're talking about what I believe are IF cans, like say, for instance, 455 KC or 267 KC or 10.7 megahertz. These are IF cans, and for some reason, the metal shield outside of the IF circuit is metal, is missing, and now he's seeing the bare coil without the metal can around it. Is that what we're describing, Eric? I mean, John? Hey, John?
Yeah, Yeah, the cans are the shields for the IF transformers, and there's three of them missing, and it really causes havoc with the radio. So he wanted to know about the material, and he believes the radio's worth the effort. So now you got an idea.
In order for him to restore the performance of those IF cans, it sure would be nice if he could get the cross-sectional dimension the same as the way it used to be. That can is creating a certain amount of magnetic shunting, and if he made the can bigger or smaller, his coils will tune a little bit differently, maybe not a whole lot. The only thing that's really required for those cans is for the material to be made out of them to be conductive and to be reasonably well grounded to the chassis. As such, I would not use aluminum, because making good RF contact and soldering or whatever to aluminum is tough. He's got a lot of choices of conducting materials: steel, brass, bronze, copperclad. He could make the cans, they would look a little bit homely, but he could make them out of copperclad printed circuit board, if you know what I mean, and solder the edges just right. So, as long as it's conducting material, even if he made it out of steel, he'd worry about the permeability of the steel. Well, the steel permeability at 455 KC is so darn low that I don't think it would be much of a difference. So he's got a lot of choices of materials. My favorite would be a galvanized tin can. Food cans have usually got some kind of a coating on the inside. That's a little bit of a problem. Turns out that your food can, and with rare exceptions, the food never touches the metal of the can. There's a plastic thin coating on the inside to make sure the food doesn't touch the can. Let me drop this. And that's part of the reason why many food cans will have a date code on them, where in theory you shouldn't use them beyond a certain date, because after a certain period of time, the food does manage to penetrate that plastic coating and get into the metal of the can. And when the acids and other substances of your food are now reacting with the can, you can end up with a bitter taste and other kinds of disadvantages. So, grass sheet would work very well. Lots of things would work very well. Does someone else want to give us a suggestion on this one? I think I heard someone else calling in. K2RIW listening.
KB2KUZ.
Oh, go right ahead, Alex.
Depending on how old the radio is and what it's worth, there is always the possibility of finding another donor radio, let's say on one of the auction sites, or one of the companies that are still out there who deal in antique radios, scavenge for the exact part and save yourself a lot of construction time.
That's an excellent suggestion, Alec. I wish I had thought of that. So, to find another sacrificial radio when you use the spare parts. One has been thrown down a flight of stairs, and it's too difficult to repair, but you can sacrifice, and you can salvage. In the Air Force, they called that canning. Quite often, there was a aircraft sitting off to the side of the runway where people had been cannibalizing it for a long time, using it for spare parts. You'd be amazed how many Air Force programs where the program was expected to last for 5 years, it really lasted for 20 years, and the short-sightedness of the people setting up the program originally didn't plan on 15 years worth of spare parts. So they had to choose a weak sister aircraft, a sacrificial aircraft, that they start cannibalizing parts off of. So there's probably radios like that out there. That would be a nice way of solving the problem. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Well, finding one like this would be a little difficult. It was made in 1938 by RCA. It has three separate chassis. One is the power supply, it's quite large. One is the radio, and the other one is a separate box, which is the squelch control. That's all it does, the squelch control. It looks almost as big as a radio. But he knows the exact dimension of them. Basically, it looks like about an inch and a quarter square, but he doesn't know the height. Maybe you can give him some advice on how to adjust the height, and he can make it out of tin cans or steel cans. Just turn them inside out. When he puts them on the brake, just do it the other way so that the digestible varnish they use in there is on the outside. So that should work for him.
Yeah, good suggestion. Brass shim, copper shim, lots of materials you can use that'll work in this thing. The height is not critical, John. The actual dimensions of the IFK as an enclosure are literally a piece of waveguide way beyond cutoff. So whether or not if the original can was 5 inches high, and he made a can 10 inches high, his example, it would behave the same. He would have to use a much longer tuning tool to get to the height of the can to get down to the slug to do the tuning, if it is a tunable IF can. But height is not critical. The cross-sectional area is critical because it is doing a certain amount of shunting of that coil and raising the frequency of the coil. So if the original can was 1.5 inches squared and he made it 2.5 inches squared, he'd still get plenty of shielding, but he'd be getting a little bit less of the shielding effect, and the net result is the coil would be running a little bit low in frequency. As you bring the dimensions of the can closer and closer to the coil goes up in frequency. So height is not critical. Set it anything that's convenient, John. KC2WGB, K2IW and TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Well, I'm sure that information will help. Well, he does have a total of 6 of these cans, and they all look the same. But the 3 that are missing, he has the stain on the chassis that shows him exactly the dimensions. So that's good if the height doesn't matter. As long as he clears the coil, he should be okay. Very good. I think he's going to have a lot of fun with that old receiver. So that's it from the mailbag. So we'll go on to Paul and his space report. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Okay, well done, John. Paul, I wonder if you were watching many of those NASA websites that I am when Juno was going into orbit, and they told you how successful it was. There's all kinds of people being interviewed from Jet Propulsion Laboratory and whatever. Lockheed, who I think actually was a major contractor for the actual spacecraft. But one of the really interesting things that took place is that for the last 13 days before Juno got to Jupiter, for 13 days, I'm going to guess they took a picture once every hour of the 4 moons of Jupiter plus Jupiter. And they believe that this is the first time in history that a real motion picture has taken place of the moons of Jupiter going around Jupiter. And when you play that movie, the 13 days of the movie plays in roughly 30 seconds. Let me drop it. You're not even aware of it. But if you jump from the beginning of the movie to the end of the movie and back to the beginning of the movie, you will see the diameter of Jupiter changing. That it did a beautiful job of registration. On each one of those individual time-lapse photographs, so to speak, Jupiter doesn't move. The moons do move. The moons also twinkle. I'd love to hear an explanation for why they twinkle in the movie. There's something about the way the movie was made, maybe the way the pixels are arranged. Maybe they were using very high gain, what you and I would call electronic gain as opposed to lens optical gain. So therefore, maybe the particular outer moon of Jupiter, Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto. Callisto is a small moon on the outside of the orbits around Jupiter, and it at times would do quite a bit of twinkling. Maybe it was walking in between the pixels of the camera. Let me drop it. But there's one other thing wrong with that movie. I know for 95% confidence, Juno approached Jupiter from what you and I would call the right-hand side. Therefore, the illumination of Jupiter from the sun should have been the left-hand side illuminated. In that movie, Jupiter is illuminated on what looks like our right-hand side, and Juno appears to be approaching from the left-hand side. I'm convinced that movie is being displayed to us upside down, a very frequent problem that happens with optical telescopes. Quite often, inverting eyepiece on your telescope, you're getting an inverted image. And if you're looking at a star cluster or a planet, in most cases, it doesn't matter. If you're looking at Jupiter, it does matter, because you know where the red spot is. It's in the southern hemisphere, as long as the picture is being displayed right side up. So I believe that picture is being displayed to us inverted. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go right ahead with space report number 209, I believe it is. You got a call.
Yes, it is. It is 209. And I did see that movie. And did make sure my grandson saw it, because I told him that the spacecraft was going to go into orbit on July 4th on Independence Day. So definitely wanted to make sure that went through. And I don't know if you saw the one with the music. That was pretty good. You know, they did a good job. They put music behind it. Now, that spacecraft was in front of Jupiter, from what I understand. It wasn't coming up to Jupiter. It got itself in front, and Jupiter came up, like, right behind it. And everybody thinks that, well, it's going to go into orbit around Jupiter. It's like, directly going from Earth, you know, over the poles. And a lot of people think, well, when it does that, it's going to go into an eclipse. It's going to lose the sun, and it never loses the sun because it was going. It's like at that point it was almost in the direction where Jupiter was traveling, so kind of like in front of it. And then the gravitational pull of Jupiter picked up on the satellite, and they slowed it down 1,212 miles per hour with their 35 minute burn as they're dropping down from the north to the south, and that's how it picked it up. Well, I'll have to look at the shadows and see what you're talking about. And then, now, when it's in orbit, let me drop it. The panels are facing Earth, and spinning. Now, as it was approaching Jupiter, and when those pictures were taken, the spacecraft was turning at 2 revolutions per minute. As it got close to Jupiter, they increased that speed to 5 revolutions per minute, and then they changed it on to 90 degrees where the panels weren't directly toward the sun. They were edge-on, because, again, it was in front of the planet. And then the burn was actually pushing it north as far as, you know, we're looking at it. So that slowed it down. But then right after it got it passed Jupiter, hours later, they did turn it, well, actually, it was all autonomous. It turned itself back to facing the Earth again. Now, by doing that, they, you know, when it was going into orbit, they had to change, because of that orientation, they changed the omnidirectional antenna. There's three main antennas. They have the high gain, and that's at the top of the bus of the spacecraft. And you're right, it was all built by Lockheed. And when they were showing it on TV, that was transmitted from Denver, Colorado, or actually Littleton, one of the suburbs of Denver. And that antenna is facing, you know, it's mounted on the bus facing us. Then what happened is they had to change the omnidirectional. And if you looked at the Deep Space Network before it changed its orientation, you could see there were many, many antennas in Goldstone, California, and Australia that were picking up Juno. They were dedicating a lot of antennas just to Juno. And the purpose was they were actually combining those signals into interferometry to try to get a stronger signal from the omnidirectional antenna on board Juno. But it looked like they were just transmitting, looking at the SpaceX network, they were just transmitting out of one antenna from here up to the spacecraft. My guess, probably, you can let me verify that, it's probably similar to what they do with Voyager. That signal was going up and then coming back automatically. And through the Doppler effect, they could tell, you know, which direction it was. They could tell the, because of the spinning of it, they could tell the RPMs that it was going at the proper speed. And then eventually, after it got into orbit, they could see that it was slowing down, going from 5 RPMs back down to 2, and also changing orientation, looking back toward the Earth. So yeah, that was pretty cool. I have a few items to go through, but if you want to comment further on Juno, we'll do that first. Back music.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock, WQVL, repeater system. Net time complete.
That's okay. Let me continue on. This is WS1.
Yeah, you caught me. I took a break. And I could hear what you're saying, but I was away from the rig. But I'm guessing it still reported, it still went to Jupiter from what we think is the right-hand side, and above Jupiter. I think it went over the North Pole first. Also, I believe, Eric, that it approached while turning roughly 2 revolutions per minute. I think they reoriented while it was 2 revolutions per minute, then speeded it up to 5. Because when you speed it up to 5 revolutions per minute, you're getting a lot more gyroscopic action, and it would take a lot more thrusting to change the orientation. Where now you got to be in the right orientation to do the burn in the right direction, and that happened to be a direction where the NEM running on battery power because solar panels are no longer aimed at the Earth. Over to you, Paul. KGRSW.
Okay, so if you don't come back, I'll just pick up and continue on. I know a program, and then we can continue on with the rest of the net. But yeah, you're right, they went on battery power, and if they couldn't successfully change the orientation, that would be mission over. They need that 400 watts. By the way, if that same spacecraft was in orbit around the Earth, it would be around, they'd say, 14 kilowatts, you know, that, because it's 20... 5 times the distance compared to us, you know, it's 5 AU, we're like 1 AU, 5 times 5, it's like 25 times, roughly 25 times less power you're going to get at Jupiter, but that 400 watts is adequate, like 430 watts, they need around 200 to keep the electronics warm, and the other couple of hundred is really dedicated to the 8 instruments on board, including the Juno cam, which was taking that picture. Juno cam was mounted on the side of the six-sided spacecraft. So as it spins, it was taking those pictures, and then they combined them to make a movie out of it. And that was very well done. Another thing to watch on NASA TV last week was the launch of Kate Rubin and her astronaut two crewmates launched from Kazakhstan, Russia, near Russia, to the International Space Station, and that went off very successful. And it was late night, 11:30 at night type of launch.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Actually, I think it was Eastern. That was a little early, probably around 9:30 Eastern Standard Time. But it was a night time for us and early morning for them. And they got off the ground okay. They spent 2 days in orbit rather than the normal 6 hours that they've managed to do in recent years. They wanted to test out the spacecraft. The spacecraft has a bunch of new designs to it. And if you want, I can go over that, but it's called the MS-01, or Soyuz MS-01. 01 is, they would normally be up to much higher numbers, but anytime they reinvent their spacecraft, they start off with 01, 02. So, it's got a bigger solar panel, roughly 1 meter square, bigger, so they can get a little bit more power. Completely different thruster set up to control the spacecraft. They've really upgraded on that. They have a duality for the for the docking tower. They put backup motors on that. So, and a few other improvements to the spacecraft, including the changing of the CURS radar. We dropped it. They did away with this, 400 or 500 pound radar system, and they went to something, I think, 1/10 less in weight than what they had, put in a new radar system. CURS had a spinning radar on the outside, and they need the radar for, the approach of the International Space Station. They still have to retract that. It was a big complicated thing right before docking, and now they don't have to do that with these small antennas. They're using some kind of small phased array antennas, and that's all the detail I have on that. I don't know frequencies or anything like that, but they're not spinning antennas, and they don't have to retract them. So it's an upgraded system. They're actually getting ready for building their new spacecraft called the Federation in the not too distant future. The Federation is going to be a spacecraft that will eventually not only be going back to the International Space Station. They plan on using it for trips to the moon. It'll be able to carry up to 4 people. And the Russians are still at it, still making improvements. It's going to be a reusable spacecraft where the Soyuz is not. Soyuz comes back. It's really 3 parts. They have the flight part that they're in. They actually call the descent module. So it takes them up and they're not supposed to come back in. The orbital module is mounted in front of them. That's the one that, after they get into space, after they climb to orbit, they can get out of their spacesuits and float around in the orbital module. They have plenty of room up there for a couple of days. And that's also the module that docks up the space station. And the third module in the back is propulsion and water and everything. And everything you need to survive. All your thrust is off of control. And when they re-enter the atmosphere at the end, after 4 or 5 months of a flight, they'll come back in the atmosphere. They're doing that. They blow apart the front module and the back module at the same time, and then re-enter in the descent module or the descent module, and they land by parachute. And that's not reusable, but these new ones called the Federation, obviously them go up for about 5 years. The first planned launch anyway is 2020. So that's something for the Russians to look forward to. And I'm sure by then we'll have our rockets going up to the space station from American soil. But my guess is they'll still be, we'll be taking them up, they'll be taking us up. It'll probably be very similar to when we had the space shuttle. We used to take Russians up, and even when we had the space shuttle, they were also taking astronauts up as well. And now you have another Progress mission going up at the end of the week on July 16th. That's going to bring a lot of stuff up to the 6-person crew that's up there now. Right now you have the 3 that were up there. By the way, by sending the 3 that just went up, 2 of them, let me drop it. The American, Kate Rubin, by the way, she's from Connecticut, not too far away, and probably not too far from Newington, looking at the map, in the middle of Connecticut. And she happens to be a ham, KG5FYJ. She's got a call letter. And the other fella from JAXA, the JAXA, that's the Japanese counterpart of NASA. That astronaut is KF5LKS. He got he's got an American call letter. He got it when he was in Houston. He spent a couple of years in Houston, just like our Americans spent a couple of years in Star City near Moscow to land for these flights. They spent years getting ready for just this one flight. We drop it.
I have a question for Paul.
Okay, John, let me just finish this one segment, and before I go on to anything new, one of the things they're bringing up is the IDA, International Docking Adapter, to the space station and Cape.